All right, welcome back to the deep dive. You know how this works. You send us the sources and we kind of pick them apart, figure out what's interesting, what's important, you know, all that good stuff. And today we're going deep on a couple of legal cases that I think are going to be really insightful, especially for any law students out there.
Yeah, definitely. We've got a great pair of cases lined up. One's a criminal case, the other's more contract law.
Right, exactly. So we'll be jumping between different areas of the law. But you know, even though they're different, there are always these like common threads, ways of thinking like a lawyer that you can pick up from any case, right?
Absolutely. Legal reasoning, looking at how courts apply the rules. That's what we're after today.
Okay. So should we start with this Sweeney v. Smith case then?
Let's do it.
Okay. So give us the rundown. What happened here?
All right. So this case comes out of Wisconsin, 1998, and it involves this guy, Ricky Sweeney, who was convicted of some pretty serious offenses. First-degree sexual assault of a child.
Okay, right off the bat, heavy stuff.
Yeah, definitely. So Sweeney goes through the whole state court process in Wisconsin, appeals and all that. But, you know, things don't go his way. So he decides to file a federal habeas corpus petition. And he does this pro se, meaning he's representing himself, which is, you know, it's not common.
I mean, it's got to be tough going up against a legal system without, you know, a lawyer in your corner. But before we go any further, can you kind of break down what this whole habeas corpus thing's about? Like, what's the point of it?
Sure. So in this context, habeas corpus is kind of like a last resort for someone who's been convicted in state court. It's a way for them to argue that their imprisonment is unlawful, not because they're innocent, but because their constitutional rights were violated during the process.
Right. So Sweeney wasn't saying, hey, I didn't do it. He was saying, hey, something went wrong with how they convicted me.
That's it. And in his petition, he actually makes three big arguments. The first one was about how Wisconsin law defines certain acts, you know, the statutes related to sexual assault. He said that by basically treating sexual contact and sexual intercourse as like the same thing for punishment purposes, it violated double jeopardy.
Double jeopardy, meaning he felt like he was being punished twice for the same act, essentially.
Right. His argument was that these were different actions, and lumping them together in the statute led to multiple punishments for what he saw as the same underlying offense.
Okay, interesting. And what were his other arguments?
So his second point was that those same Wisconsin statutes were too vague. Like, they didn't give him clear enough notice about what was actually illegal, which, he claimed, violated his right to due process.
You know, the classic, I didn't know it was wrong defense.
Well, not quite. It's more nuanced than that. Due process means laws have to be clear enough that a regular person can understand them. So he's saying the law wasn't clear enough for him to know he was breaking it.
Okay, I see. And his third claim?
His third argument was that the Wisconsin laws actually violated the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution because they conflicted with some federal law.
Okay, so we've got three big constitutional claims here. Let's break them down one by one. What did the court say about his double jeopardy argument?
Okay, so this is where it gets into some really important principles about how federal courts handle state criminal cases. Basically, there's this idea of federalism, which means that states have a lot of power to run their own affairs, including their criminal justice systems. And federal courts tend to give states a lot of leeway in defining their own criminal laws. You know, they try not to step on each other's toes.
Yeah, makes sense. So what did that mean for Sweeney's argument?
Well, the court basically said that Wisconsin had the right to define those acts, sexual contact and intercourse, the way it did, unless there was a specific federal law saying they couldn't, or if the way they defined it clearly violated the Constitution, the federal court wasn't going to overturn Wisconsin's law. And Sweeney couldn't show that any of that was happening.
So Wisconsin was within its rights to write its law that way, and Sweeney's double jeopardy claim didn't hold up. What about the argument that the law was too vague?
The court didn't buy that one either. They looked at the actual wording of the Wisconsin statutes and said, no, it's clear enough. A reasonable person would understand that what Sweeney did was against the law.
So no due process violation there. And lastly, what about the Supremacy Clause claim?
Right. So the Supremacy Clause basically says that if there is a conflict between a state law and a federal law, the federal law wins. But Sweeney didn't really show any direct conflict like that. He just kind of argued that Wisconsin needed permission from the federal government to make those laws, which isn't how the Supremacy Clause works.
So that one failed too. But his whole habeas petition gets thrown out, right? What was the final nail in the coffin, so to speak?
This is where it gets into the nitty-gritty of habeas procedure. There's this rule, Rule 4 of the Rules Governing Section 2254 Cases, which basically sets a standard for what needs to be in a habeas petition. It says that right off the bat, the petition has to show that the person filing it is entitled to relief. You know, it has to make a believable case that their rights were violated. This is called a prima facie showing.
So it's like a first test. Does this even deserve to be heard?
Exactly. And the court said that Sweeney's petition, even though he was representing himself, didn't pass that test. It didn't present enough evidence or strong enough legal arguments to suggest that the Wisconsin courts had messed up so badly that it violated the Constitution.
Okay, so big picture. What should we as law students take away from this whole Sweeney v. Smith case?
Well, there are a couple of really important takeaways. First, states have a lot of power to define crimes and set punishments, and federal courts are generally going to respect that unless there's a clear constitutional problem. Second, getting a habeas corpus petition granted in federal court is really tough. You have to show that something went seriously wrong in the state court, not just that you disagree with the outcome.
Got it. So high bar for habeas relief, and states get a lot of leeway in defining their criminal laws. All right, well, that was a deep dive into the criminal side of things. Now, let's switch gears completely.
Time for some contract law.
Exactly. So this second case, the one with the Bayshore Terminal Company, this one's from way back in 1907.
That's right. Over a century ago, this one goes way back.
All right, set the scene for us. What was going on back then?
Okay, so picture this. 1905, Bayshore Terminal Company, they ran a street railway, but they hit some hard times, you know, financially. So they go into receivership, which is kind of like bankruptcy for a company.
Got it. So they're in trouble.
Yeah. And when this happens, a committee is formed to represent the company's bondholders. These are the people who loaned money to the company, right? And this committee, they're given a lot of power to manage the company's assets during the receivership.
So they're basically calling the shots, trying to figure out how to deal with the mess.
Exactly. So in September of 1905, this committee makes a deal. They sign a contract with someone. The case just calls them the complainant, giving this person the right to buy a bunch of the company's bonds and stock. And they're getting them at a discount, 40% of their face value.
A sweet deal.
Yeah, potentially. But here's the thing. The original contract, it didn't say when this guy had to buy the stuff. No deadline.
Ah, okay. So he's got this option, but no rush.
Right. Now, fast forward a few months to January 1906. The same committee, they make another deal. This time, it's with these two guys, Groner and Taylor, who are working for a company called E.B. Smith & Co. And this new contract basically gives them the same option to buy the bonds and stock.
So hold on. They've now promised these assets to two different parties.
Yeah, it seems that way. And to make things even more complicated, E.B. Smith & Co., they actually went ahead and exercised their option. They got the bonds. And they use them to buy up the terminal company's property at a foreclosure sale.
So the first guy, the original complainant, he gets totally cut out of the deal.
That's how it played out. And that's what leads to the lawsuit. He sues E.B. Smith & Co. saying, hey, they interfered with his contract and the profits they made should rightfully belong to him.
So this is where the whole question of contract interference comes in, right?
You got it. But here's a super important detail. The lawsuit, it doesn't say that E.B. Smith & Co. did anything sneaky or dishonest. There's no claim of fraud or lying or anything like that.
So they knew about the first deal, but didn't try to, like, trick the committee into breaking it.
Right. They just took advantage of the situation. And that's why this case is so interesting. It really gets at the heart of what it means to interfere with a contract.
Right. So legally speaking, what did the court say about all this? Did they think E.B. Smith & Co. did anything wrong?
Well, the court laid down a really clear rule. They said that for someone to be liable for interfering with a contract, they have to do more than just know about it. They have to actually do something to cause the breach. The court used the phrase actively induce or persuade.
So like going behind the first guy's back, trying to convince the committee to break their agreement with him.
Something like that. And the court even went on to say this, and this is worth remembering. Mere knowledge of the first does not make the second an actionable wrong. In other words, simply knowing about the first contract doesn't automatically make you liable if you step in and make your own deal.
So it sounds like there's a line between, like, being a smart business person and being a legal troublemaker.
That's a good way to put it. The court wanted to protect the idea of competition. You know, if you see an opportunity to make a better deal, you should be able to go for it, as long as you're not playing dirty.
Right, that makes sense.
Yeah, and the court even used an analogy to make this point. They said E.B. Smith & Co. was basically just taking advantage of a situation, like someone who finds a lost dog and returns it for a reward. They didn't do anything to cause the dog to get lost in the first place.
Okay, that's actually a really helpful way to think about it.
Yeah.
So, bottom line, what's the big lesson from the Bayshore case?
The takeaway is that just knowing about a contract isn't enough to make you liable for interfering with it. You have to actively do something to cause one of the parties to break the agreement.
So you have to be more than just a bystander. You have to be a participant in the breach, essentially.
Precisely.
All right, so we've got these two cases, Sweeney v. Smith and the Bayshore Terminal case. One's criminal, the other's contract. They seem pretty different on the surface, but are there any, like, bigger themes that connect them? Anything we can learn from looking at them together?
Oh, absolutely. I think there are some really important common threads here, especially for law students who are still learning how to think about the law. Well, one thing they both highlight is the need to be specific in your legal arguments. In Sweeney, it wasn't enough for him to just say, hey, I think this is unfair. He had to point to a specific part of the Constitution that he thought was violated.
Right.
And in the Bayshore case, it wasn't enough for the complainant to just say, E.B. Smith & Co. knew about my contract. He had to show that they did something specific to get the committee to break that contract.
So you can't just complain in general terms. You have to identify the exact legal wrong.
Exactly. And both cases also show how courts try to balance different interests. Like in Sweeney, the court was balancing the rights of the individual with the power of the state to enforce its laws.
Right. And in the Bayshore case, it was balancing the need to protect contracts with the idea that businesses should be able to compete freely.
You got it. And these are themes that come up all the time in the law, no matter what area you're looking at.
So even though these are older cases, they're still relevant because they teach us about these fundamental legal principles.
Exactly. And for law students, I think Sweeney is a great example of how habeas corpus works and its limitations. It shows you how high that bar is for getting a federal court to overturn a state conviction.
And the Bayshore case.
That one gives you a really solid foundation for understanding what it means to interfere with a contract. And that's a concept that comes up all the time in business law, so it's super relevant.
All right. Well, that was a really interesting look at two very different cases. As always, we like to leave our listeners with something to ponder. So, any final thoughts?
Well, thinking about these two cases, I'd ask our listeners to consider this. How do the legal principles we've talked about, the need for specific claims, the balance between different interests, the thresholds for intervention, how do these reflect the bigger picture of how our legal system works? What do they tell us about how we decide when and why the law should step in and resolve disputes?
Ooh, deep. That's something for our listeners to chew on.
Yeah, exactly. Some food for thought.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for today's deep dive. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. And don't forget to keep sending us your sources.